This week's episode of Still Untitled is brought to you by the new Unscaled series from the All Turtles podcast. AI is changing nearly everything about the way businesses grow and solve problems. This shift requires a new understanding of the word scale, and entrepreneurs need to pay attention. This 8-part podcast series looks at how startups and founders can use a new unscaled model to make products with impact. Listen to this provocative new series at allturtlespodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Now on with the show.
Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Nor.
Okay, hello, so, given we were all doing radio voices there, I was listening to 99% Invisible last week.
Roman Mars has a lovely voice.
Oh, no, this is a given that Roman's radio voice is phenomenal. But there was a second voice within the reportage of the episode that sounded like Roman's voice sped up a little bit.
Maybe they have fast Roman and slow Roman.
I was meaning to write to him
and
ask.
Which episode was it? Do you remember?
Hold on, I'll tell you because it was a very recent one.
This is the thing with podcasts and radio. You're really into it when you're listening to it, but what
it's
sticks? It's gone.
As soon as I put my key in the front door,
that's
gone.
Right. But the feeling when you're in it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm going to stay in my driveway.
I think it was Bundyville.
Okay.
It's the most recent one about the government and the Clive and Bundy and that whole business.
I, as part of my new life as the dad of a kindergartner, I spend a lot of time talking to the other parents about what you do for a job.
Right.
Because it's what they, you know, people, it's the default question. And
sure.
I'm like, well, I run a VR company where we make cartoons and also I podcast some.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I want to start a podcast. And I'm like, I think that's a great idea. Here's what you need to do. And I can send you some links.
Yeah.
But seriously, like I was talking to some people the other day who wanted to do a podcast about like their life experiences and some really specific, really personal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, look, you know, why do you want to do this? She's like, I want to have a constructed reason to talk about it with a person who's important to me on a regular basis. So I was like, that is exactly the right reason to start a podcast.
Absolutely.
You could also just, you know, call your friends.
Well, but I mean, I think that there's, so this is something we talked about with the Idle Thumbs guys years ago. Like the mere act of them talking about making video games, they think has changed. Like it's made them better. They make video games for a living.
Right.
It's made them better at communicating. They have a shared language of video games they've built up over many years of sitting and talking to each other for an hour or two at a time.
Yeah.
And as a result, they're better at making video games because when they say one thing, they all have the exact same mental picture of it now, which is a hard thing to do.
Look, I'll tell you, talking about stuff is completely useful. There, many of the primary realizations I had about what Mythbusters was about came about on stage in interviews with an interlocutor and Jamie and I.
And just, when it's for the public, there are some stakes to it, and you're definitely in a different frame of mind.
Yeah, and you want to explain something. Something happens off the cuff, and you're like, oh my God, that's deeply true. Hold on, that actually changes the way I think about making this show. And that's, like, I love that process.
Well, and I mean, that's one of those things. It's often when you see, I think when you see a sophomore slump in a show, like True Detective is a great example. We all watch True Detective.
That was a sophomore slump.
Well, no, but I mean, we watched that first season, and I think the audience had a completely different idea of what was magical and amazing about that season of TV than maybe the creators did. And they took the other path, and we were all wanting them to take a different path.
Yeah.
My point is, do it for the right reasons.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you're not going to make a ton of money podcasting.
As a tangential note to that, I was making a commercial with... Jamie and I did a thing with Corning Glass a few years ago called The Day of Glass.
Yeah.
And it was super, Corning was an amazing company to work for. They're an amazing company, full stop, right? Like it was an easy yes for a giant corporate client. We brought in Drew Takahashi, who used to be one of the owners of Colossal Pictures, my old boss, and he directed the crap out of this thing. It was stunning, and the edit was great. And I said to a friend of mine who's a longtime commercial director, is it ever this great? And he's like, yeah, occasionally it's this great. And I'm like, how do you keep that going? And he's like, you can't. And I was like, really? Like, even if this client hired me again? And he goes, here's the thing. When a commercial is really good and working on it is really good, and then it like goes on to be good and win awards, if you do another commercial for the same company, all of a sudden, everyone now wants in on the success train, and they will jump in with their opinions, and there'll be all of these cooks in the kitchen, and it will be shit.
Because by virtue of you doing a commercial and working for someone in the first place as work for hire,
right.
there's already that power dynamic,
right.
the creative versus but where like, money
so
came
let's
from.
Say you do it because no one's paying attention. I mean, we did the first Pilots and Mythbusters with a crew of four.
Yeah.
Right, that just doesn't happen anymore. And so, you know, he's like, he's done many commercials where it was like the agency wasn't super on him. They kind of let him do what he wanted to do. He did a great commercial, and then they're like, we got to do that again. And they went and did it again. The second one, always terrible.
Having done a handful of commercial shoots, some of which you guys know about, some of which we can't talk about,
yeah.
like the difference, a lot of it is on the agency partner and how much they trust the creative team and like, and also kind of how much they keep the creative team in check. Because sometimes people on our side get a little out of control.
And yeah, that's absolutely right. I want to make sure I'm not advocating that you have to always leave the creatives alone, because you can't and you shouldn't. I mean, you're spending money. You should be monitoring your money, and you want to know that you're getting value for it. That's totally reasonable. Well,
yeah. Why, you know, most of the people who went up last night to receive their awards for the Emmys thank not only their creative partners, but mostly their producing partners and the networks that paid and managed them.
That pay up $10 million per episode sometimes.
They're the ones who made it possible.
Yeah. Nice segue, Norm.
That was a really, really
well done.
You said what award. Done. I'm like, ooh, there you go.
if there's ever a podcasting award for best segue, I feel like
man, that's like a lower tier podcast award.
Potty.
Potty. There you go.
The potty.
It's like a little toilet with a microphone.
Yeah, it's a potty mouth is what the trophy is.
It's the awards for the medium designed to make you yell at your car radio.
So the Emmys were yesterday.
The primetime Emmys.
I did not watch them.
Well, they do two sets of Emmys, because like last Sunday I was
the Creative Arts Emmys.
Is it the Emmys? And then it wasn't. It was kind of the Emmys.
The Creative Arts. Yeah. Those are the Emmys that I lost 8 times.
Okay.
Is the Creative Arts Emmys.
At least you were nominated 8 times.
I'm not bitter.
At least you were nominated 8 times. It's a pleasure to just be nominated.
Lee and Megan Amram are on the same team.
And Kumail from Silicon Valley. You know, Silicon Valley has won whatever the streak is for losing every single Emmy they've ever been nominated for.
Really?
Yeah. Every acting, everything. They've been nominated so many times.
Wow.
It's very competitive.
I will say, you know, what do you call it? The Amazing Race won for Best Host for like 20 years
Phil
in a row.
Phil seems pretty good.
Oh, he's wonderful. Yeah. He's fantastic. But I really appreciate that RuPaul's been taking home Best Host for the last 4 years.
This is
a category I wanted to get nominated in several times and paid for campaigns. Jamie and I did, and it never came to fruition. But like, I'm glad there's some new blood, and RuPaul's a terrific recipient and well deserved.
It's funny because you watch that. I watched Survivor. I've watched a lot of Amazing Race over the years. Like, watching somebody who's really adroit at that kind of hosting is because like it's not like, I mean, Phil doesn't ask a lot of questions. He's not trying to get information out of the players.
Yeah.
But when Jeff Probst is trying to elicit the reaction he wants, he's playing those contestants like a piano.
Yeah, no, it's so one of the weirdest days I ever spent as a television talent was in a prep for the Emmys, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. The LA Times paid for 4 Emmy nominees to spend a couple of hours chatting. Ooh. So it was me, Phil Keegan, Heidi Klum, and Padma Lakshmi.
I remember this.
Oh, yeah. You told us about this.
That was a far out day.
I have to imagine that was an unusual day.
It was great. Look, you know, these are 3 ludicrously smart people who are at the top of their game. I mean, Heidi Klum is just delightful to hear her opine about anything. She's crazy intelligent. And so is Padma.
Yeah. The episode of Hot Ones with Padma is, I think, my favorite.
I haven't watched it.
Oh, you've got to watch that one.
All right.
Because she's just like, she's ready to go.
Yeah, totally.
And is so used to talking while having challenging eating experiences that she just doesn't break stride. Like, even, and it's exceptional. Like, he's
amazing.
He kind of doesn't know how to manage it because it's so unusual in his experience. Like, usually everybody breaks.
As he points out, the women always do better than the men.
Yeah.
On that show.
Hot Ones is a YouTube series where I can't remember the host's name, but they basically have an escalating series of wings.
It's shameful that we don't have his name at the tip of our tongues, because he's a phenomenal host and a really, really incredible interviewer with insanely insightful questions that probe deep. And so his method is he eats successively hotter wings along with his guest, and it's times 10, you know, just 10 wings. And the last one is like, you know, set your house on fire hot. Yeah. But what he does is he takes a bite, his guest takes a bite, and then he immediately asks a deeply probing question while they're in extreme pain.
While they're having this incredible mouth experience,
and you get to see people kind of stripped bare.
It's very good.
It looks painful.
It does. I want to do this show.
I know, but I want you to say that because, like, you're campaigning, clearly.
I am. I want to be on this show, and I'm ready.
Touch your eyes.
We can make an audition video.
I had the hot fried chicken from Westbury yesterday for lunch.
And I had a sandwich at the Presidio Picnic on Sunday from Hot Bird in Oakland that was just it was like a sweet bun with some slaw and some pickles and then this fried chicken breast that had the breading almost crumbled. It was unlike anything I'd ever had. Like, it was soft but really crunchy, and they dipped it in hot sauce, and it was amazing.
Sounds amazing.
It was very good.
Okay, back to the Emmys.
Yeah, sure.
Back to the Emmys. Emmys, like every award show, when we talk about like the Oscars and other awards before, it's a weird institution, right? Because like the validation that a creative team gets, it's critical validation, but who votes for the Emmys? Is it their peers? Is it like the Golden Globes where it's the foreign press?
No. It is small groups of peers for each of the categories in general. And then there are several categories that are voted on by the entire...
The big categories, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in the general public, I think that's not as transparent as it always can be, because the assumption, the public, the way it's presented, these big awards, is that these are the definitive ranking. Like, this is like... It will stand the test of time.
Right.
It will be in the tome as the best of that year.
Oh, no, I'm quite sure. Because being an Emmy member and a voter, I get these packets, and there are only certain categories I'm allowed to vote in because of the specificity of my job. I'm quite convinced that there are some Emmy categories in which, you know, the vote's being decided by 10 or 15 people. I think the margins are probably very small sometimes.
And as we are familiar with, because, you know, we've won Webbies on Tested, the submission process, there's so much stuff to watch, right? A lot of times it's what's submitted for the panel to vote on. Is it's your best foot forward, but it's the one foot, not necessarily the entire path you took.
Well, and the other problem while we're talking about Emmy stuff is that we're living this amazing age of television where things are happening that are deeper than comedy or drama.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is something that that we dealt with on MythBusters, and this isn't sour grapes. It's just, you know, to talk about it. Like, there are like seven different genres of reality television, and many times the roster of nominees in our category would be like five different types of show, and they have reality competition, they have reality scripted and unscripted. But even still, like within fiction and nonfiction television, there are far more categories. And I'm not saying you have to accommodate every single one, but right now it feels like they're very limited.
Well, it's a Golden Globes problem of the, you know, The Martian as best comedy or musical.
So at one point, the head of Discovery PR was lobbying for new categories for reality television. And the Emmy Academy member she was talking to said, well, let me ask you this. Is MythBusters more candid camera or Wild Kingdom? And she was like, both of those shows are more than 40 years old. maybe we should have some more recent cultural markers.
Well, there's a Simpsons.
This is about 10 years ago. I don't want to cast dispersions.
As with anything, there's a Simpsons joke for this, which is that, you know, the Simpsons variety album is up in the best new hip hop or comedy album category. Right. So, look, I mean, they could introduce the most popular TV show category. That seems like a thing that's happening right now.
Well, it's also a thing that, I as we've talked about before, the public, we want a number one. We want one thing. Like, we would not be happy as a public if the Emmys or the Oscars said, here is the best five of the year, and that's it.
And what's funny about that wanting the number one, I was at a small cocktail party on Saturday night where someone asked me, what's your favorite movie? And I said, there's at least 30 movies in my top 10, my standard line. And I said, what? And we talked about some of my favorite movies. And I said, what's your favorite movie? And like,
Clockwork Orange.
No. he didn't have a ready answer. None of us do. There's no way you could. I just don't think there's any way you can reasonably. Most people can reasonably say this one thing is the best for of all for me.
Right now, between my favorite movie is 18 Thor and 21.
Right. Right between the ages of right. Know, December 2017 and September 2018.
Yep. Yeah. Movies that were important to you. Movies that you loved this year. Movies that really blew your mind. Movies that you love but can't watch anymore.
It's okay to change.
Yes.
Hey, everybody, before we continue with this discussion, I want to let you know that this episode of Still Entitled is also brought to you by Wolverine The Long Night. That's right. Marvel just released Wolverine The Long Night, their first ever scripted podcast, for free. It's a really interesting take on taking a comic book character and incorporating it into this narrative audio-only form, kind of like an old radio drama. You can listen to it right now online or in your podcast app. The story starts when a fishing boat is found off the coast of Burns, Alaska, and Special Agents Sally Pierce and Tad Marshall arrived to find out who or what killed the crew, and their primary suspect is a drifter named Logan. The local police won't cooperate, and there's more going on in Burns that meets the eye. With a great vocal cast with people like Richard Armitage and also Bob Balaban, Scott Adsit, Chris Gethard, you'll want to check this out. You haven't heard anything like this before. The sound design, the acting, the writing, it's really amazing. Check it out. Wolverine The Long Night is free in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, or you can visit wolverinepodcast.com for more info. Thank them for sponsoring this episode, and back to the conversation.
I just went back and rewatched Dune a couple of, I wasn't feeling too good.
The David Lynch one.
Yeah. And I hadn't watched it. Since HD was a thing.
Yeah.
Because the version I had was on DVD. So I'd gotten a Blu-ray and I sat, put it in and watched it. And man, that movie is A, completely different to me now than it was the last time I watched it.
Fascinating.
And I still love it. Like it is not a good movie in a lot of ways. It's paced really badly and there's a lot of weird stuff in there.
Yeah.
But it's still a really important movie to me.
And you know what? It's probably not the same to you now as when you watched it as a kid, because the way you watched it is different. Yeah. And the great thing about technology and the availability of these films is we are getting to watch these films in closer to the original
exceptional segue.
I'm also really impressed.
Yeah, I mean this is. I kind of love you, far right field one there, and you just reached for it, man.
Easy.
This is amazing.
We got an email from a friend of ours.
From Kevin Kelly, friend of the show last night, sent Norm and I an email, and sent a link to an article about Christopher Nolan's cut campaign against motion smoothing on TV.
Which is, so this, to be clear, this is like you buy a brand new television from Best Buy and bring it home and put a DVD player in and watch an old movie in it, and it's going to look crisper than you often.
Yeah.
It will look crisper than you ever saw it before and will almost look like soap opera video in its overscanned look. It doesn't have that 24 frame per second sort of lull that normal film does. It doesn't have grain. That's been taken out by the deinterlacing and whatever stuff they're doing. It drives me absolutely batty.
And so much of that stuff that's built in the TVs and the problem that we agree is it's being turned on by default is that it compensates for the medium that a lot of television is transferred today, like the poor digital signals. They're cleaning up the poor sports signals.
Well, and to be clear, like when you watch sports on a new TV, it is a completely amazing experience. It feels like you are there in the arena better than actually being in the arena.
There's tiny little people inside the box on your wall.
Being in the arena is not what a filmmaker necessarily wants you to be.
I totally agree. So a friend of mine teaches film at State, and he had Walter Murch come to do a lecture for the class. And the projector, Walter Murch, the amazing sound designer for The Conversation, director of Return to Oz, and he did direct Return to Oz. Amazing, legendary film guy. And he would not watch his film on the projector they had at State because it was too overscanned. He's like, this isn't the movie I made. We will not watch it on this medium.
Well, so motion smoothing is the latest in a long line of features that TV manufacturers have turned on to make their TV look awesome when it's on the wall at Best Buy and you're sitting there going, well, this one looks a little bit brighter than that one. I should, that's how people make their decision sometimes.
And to be clear, often the ones on the wall are way overtuned to
always,
yeah,
demo mode,
100% of the time.
Yeah,
when you turn, in fact, actually, most of the time when you buy a new TV and turn it on, now it says, "Hey, is this for the showroom or is this for your house?"
Oh, does it really?
Mine did when I bought my TV years ago.
Wow.
And right now that affects the color saturation. I think part of what Christopher Nolan is saying is that, hey, maybe we should put motion smoothing in that category too, or maybe we should be smarter about it. But
we should be smarter about it. It makes movies look like crap.
Well, and what it does is it interpolates additional frames in between the frames that are there to get it to 60 hertz or 120 hertz or whatever the TV's
target frame rate is. Right, and it doesn't feel like film. It doesn't. No. I mean, I'm a proponent of detuning your television, and I've worked hard to detune all of my media playback devices so that it works right.
I'm going to take to a logical extreme, because I think we can all agree motion smoothing bad, getting rid of grain necessarily sometimes.
Getting rid of if the film was shot with grain and you master the grain out, mm-hmm. which is if you denoise the grain, you've done a bad thing.
And to be fair, it's not just the TV manufacturers do this. Sometimes it's the studios themselves as they release their remastered versions.
Well, it's the remastering houses.
On DVD and Blu-ray.
Right. The point you bring up is, the question is, how do we value film as historical artifact in our culture? And there was a long article, God, I can't even remember where I read it a couple of weeks ago, about the fact that even the streaming service with the most numerous amount of videos has a fraction of the number of films that you could own on DVD. Mm-hmm. Like, there are video stores in the United States with 15 to 20,000 titles that you can go see in really faithful original formats. And what does Amazon have? 2,500 films that they can stream?
So Netflix has 4,000 pieces of content right now, but most, the majority of that is individual episodes of kids' TV shows. A lot of it seems like. I'm not trying to be shitty, but that's they know what the market is.
Always changes,
and so it shouldn't be expected that because you can stream it, that now the whole film library will be available on streaming. Or available in its original format. Well, in that tweet this week of
Brian Tolarico from Ebert.com and a bunch of other places.
Showing Die Hard?
Die Hard.
On HBO.
I have the pictures here. First you see the Blu-ray, and it's the 2.39:1 original aspect ratio of the film. And there's bars above and below. And then you scroll over and you see what Netflix looks like, or HBO Now looks like. And it's a crop.
It's appalling.
16:9.
Yeah, that's, you're not watching the movie.
But I would also say, because I do want to take it to the logical extreme. At some point, you know, the home experience isn't what the filmmaker intended either. And to Christopher Nolan makes films to be watched with large audiences in a cinema.
So what are you advocating for?
Well, that's what I want to discuss. Where do we draw a line to say, and that line is always changing.
Before we go on, I want to make sure that we know it wasn't HBO that chose that. Like, the studio hands the streaming service the version that they want them to display. So presumably somebody at HBO could have said, hey, this isn't the right version of this film.
Look, but I'm advocating going to theaters.
Yes.
Right, sure. I totally agree with that. And, you know, I appreciate...
What does your kid do, Norm?
I appreciate the CEO of IMAX talking about all the streaming services coming to him and talking to him about stuff being projected in IMAX, which is great. Mm-hmm. I love services like Criterion Collection has a wonderful service called Filmstruck, mm-hmm. Where they curate rosters of classic movies that aren't being streamed, that are hard to find in their most faithful aspect ratios. Mm-hmm. Those are really important things to support. And it comes down to viewers also making their voice heard about what they want to see and how they want to watch it.
Look, if you, as always, the answer to this is if you care, buy the disc, right? Because the people who do the remasters and put together the discs tend to be more preservation focused, at least since the pan and scan DVD era dark times of the late 90s.
And maybe the discs are, because there were some really bad DVDs.
Right? Oh, there's some famously absolutely
bad DVDs.
Back Matrix, to the Future, Gladiator, all sorts of stuff.
And the discs now, the UHDs with HDR, they are only as good as they are because the market demands it. Because the people on the ABS forums are demanding the quality. They're the people.
That's a really good point.
Well, and there's 15 or 20 years of history of those people saying, "Hey, look, man, like remember anamorphic DVDs? People were like, hey, if we squinch the pixels then you'll get an extra 20 lines of resolution on either side, and it looks better on a 16 by 9 TV.
Look, I think that you should be watching the film at home with whatever black bars gets you to the correct aspect ratio that the DP was looking through the eyepiece to frame for.
Well, but that's not even always accurate, because sometimes the DP would shoot full frame, and then they'd mat it in post.
Whatever the so, you know. whatever the filmmaker
intended. When I watch The Dark Knight in IMAX scenes, I only see it in 16 by 9, but in IMAX it was more 4 by 3.
But you know, that's a good example, though. That's a real problem.
Actually, it is there's the famous thing of the Kubrick note to projectionists for 2001, that which is still in some dispute as to what is the proper aspect ratio to watch some of these movies.
Right?
In. I don't remember.
70 mil. It's super. But yeah, so this is like the interesting thing is now we're at a point with televisions. A, turn off motion smoothing. B, don't be the person that goes to people's houses and turns off motion smoothing for them. Have a conversation, but don't be shitbag about it.
Look, also, let's just be, you know, I think there is a complacency right now because most people aren't buying the disc. I think there's a complacency right now to imagine, oh, well, it's all online anyway. And the thing that I think has been becoming much more clear, and it is for me as a researcher, is for you guys to understand this, the internet is not the repository of all knowledge. It's the index of the repository of all knowledge. It's not all out there.
It holds everything popular.
And then it holds arrows to a lot of other stuff. Right. But it's really important if there are movies that you love, make your voice heard to the film services that you pay for, that you want to see these and how you want to watch them.
I have to imagine that big services like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and Filmstruck and stuff like that are using the search results of, hey, I searched for Bridge Over the River Kwai and it's not on the service.
Right.
And like
right.
they look
yeah,
at that
you're probably
stuff
right.
as a really good indicator about what people want to watch. I think that it is important to think about how these kind of ephemeral streaming services are impacting our archives. This is why I run a Plex server.
Yeah.
I have a machine that runs in my garage around the clock and has a couple thousand movies on it that I've ripped off of Blu-rays and DVDs because it's the stuff that I want to have available, whether Amazon or Netflix or whatever has a deal with the places. You know,
and this
is going to be more relevant next year when Disney turns on their streaming service and all of the Disney, all of the Marvel, all of the Star Wars stuff drops off of Netflix and Amazon, all the streaming services.
That's going to be a weird world.
Yeah. Getting the disc now for a present is like the new getting the socks for a present. Like, you know how like people,
you have to understand, I'm of the
now.
Age where actually I love socks.
No, exactly.
As a present.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Oh, okay. It used to be the cool thing. I love getting socks. Like, socks are so uncool, but now they're cool. Now I'm like, getting the disc is cool now. Well, I don't care about the streaming. I want the UHD disc.
And I mean, the other thing about the streaming services that I love about getting discs is you get all the extra stuff.
Right.
Like, learned so much from listening to director's commentaries over the years.
Totally.
And a lot of times, the streaming, the iTunes, even if you buy it on iTunes, you won't get the commentary.
Well, you'll get a subset.
Yeah, it's just a subset of the extras. Most of the extras will always be on the disc. And you know, most of the discs now come with the code if you want the convenience of getting it on whatever streaming service. So you get two copies.
They expire after 2 years.
I did not...
But all of my, like, all...
ownership is dead.
The funny thing is, all of the Blu-rays that I redeemed the code for are now 4K on iTunes. Because they upgraded all their 1080p stuff to 4K without you doing anything.
It's a weird ownership world. Is dead. You hear about that thread, that guy who...
Yeah, but it turns out it might have been a region coding issue that he was having. There are many layers to this story.
The story is that someone was extremely frustrated with iTunes because...
Don't get me wrong. There are a million and a half reasons to be frustrated with the scourge on humanity that is iTunes.
Right. And on Windows, on Mac. But the service for renting movies, bought a movie, as everyone who does.
To a movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the movie, iTunes lost the rights to... deliver
his
that movie
disappeared from his library, and when he reached out to iTunes, they were like, "Oh, that movie's no longer available on our service."
So here's a code for three rentals or something.
Here's a $5.99 code for a free rental. However, it turns out, and this sounds very plausible, that it might have been a region coding thing. He might have moved to a different region.
Oh, so he like went to Japan or something,
right.
And it didn't work.
So
when he was in Japan.
Yeah. If you owned a DVD that was region coded, which they almost all of them are,
you'd have to buy a region coded.
You'd have exactly that problem.
It takes about 30 seconds to strip the region lock with a DVD drive. It's really easy to
unless
rip DVDs these days.
It's a Sony DVD player. Those are nightmares to strip the region coding on.
Not
really?
Adam, everything's real easy on DVD these days. DVD is well and truly broken.
The last time I tried to strip a Sony machine of its original coding.
If you need some help, I can hook you up.
The frustration that springs out is the concept of ownership and what is it that you buy.
Yeah, it does.
And even when you buy the disc, you are buying the license to play that disc at home for personal home use.
Right.
That's what those warning signs were.
Look, I'm good. Plex.tv. It's a great, it's a great thing. You rip your discs, you put them on there. You don't have to watch the FBI warning ever. Ben Affleck never tells you how many people are employed in making the film.
Okay.
And you can just enjoy your
thing. There's an ad on TV for Quest, Quest. It was like a fiber network. It was maybe
another
like
company teaching people how to spell wrong.
Right.
Like look, all the real words are used, Adam.
Warehouse.
We can't use them anymore.
You gotta Google this on YouTube. It's like maybe a 15 or 20 year old ad, and it's a commercial that stuck with me because it's a woman who walks up to into a motel,
yeah,
and says, "Oh, what movies do you have on? What things can I rent? Because you used to go to a front desk to get behind the counter the VHSs or the DVDs,
yeah."
And the guy, this lethargic guy behind, I go, "With every single movie ever made, anytime you want to watch it." How is that possible? Quest. And 20 years ago, I was like, "Whoa, this is the dream." And 4 or 5 years ago, we reached that dream of every single movie we'd ever want, except because of licensing and
well,
legal problems, we have the nightmare version of that.
I mean, look,
the dystopia.
We're working toward the dystopia on
okay,
all fronts now.
I want to move off of this, we're all in agreement with our complaining. Hey, last week I took the one wheel up to the top of Twin Peaks.
Uphill inclined.
Is there a joke here?
I'm contrasting Norm's great segues with a terrible one.
I wouldn't ride the electric unicycle up to the top of Twin Peaks, I don't think.
It was awesome. I wasn't planning to go to the top of Twin Peaks. I was having one of those bad days in the shop where things weren't working. My brain wasn't in the right place. So I was like, you know what? I need a ride. And so I got on the one wheel and I struck out, and I was up on 17th Street, and I thought, I'm going to go to the top of 17th Street. And I got to the top of 17th Street, and I'd only used 30% of my power to get there. And I thought, I think I've got enough to get all the way up to Twin Peaks. And I did.
You know,
and then you rode back down?
And then I rode back down. Here's the best part.
Powered by the sense of your own self-satisfaction.
Yeah, it's like Ed Begley Jr.
At the top, I had used 50% of my power. And when I come all the way back down, I'd still only use 50% because it has regenerative braking.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I need to borrow one of those one day and go learn how to ride it.
Anytime.
Because
careful.
Of course.
Regenerative braking is the great metaphor for achievement in our life. If you reach the top of the mountain, that's all you need. It's like Gattaca. Just the energy to get there. You don't need to save anything for the way back.
Wow.
That's deeply philosophical.
Gattaca's held up.
We're going to leave you with that deep thought this week.
Yeah, next week on Norm's Deep Thoughts.
Don't expect any.
What's coming up on the site this week, Norm?
We had a wonderful visit last week. Actually, a bunch of visits to the cave.
Yeah.
Oh, I was here only one time, man.
And one of them was from a puppeteer named Barnaby Dixon.
Dude.
He's from the UK.
You've seen his stuff.
His videos, his take on puppeteering on Facebook and YouTube. Check out, subscribe
really
to his channel.
Largely self-invented.
Yes, incredibly. From the puppets he designs and the mechs. And we learned a lot about his process and his origins. I didn't realize that, you know, for example, he used to be a stop-motion animator.
That totally makes sense. Truly amazing stuff from him and a wonderful conversation. It was delightful to have him in here.
Barnaby Dixon. Yeah, so that'll be on the site this week.
Cool.
And then I paid a visit to a new friend, Voodoo FX, a guy who makes lighting kits for models.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
We have used some of his lighting kits.
Yes, exactly. And saw how he designs lighting and electronics kits for off-the-shelf models.
Oh, that's awesome.
I am barreling down finishing my costume for my Incognito in New York at New York's Comic-Con.
Ooh.
Slowly but surely.
Next month, right?
Yeah, very soon.
Wow. Less than half a month now.
Wow.
All right.
Well, okay, Adam, flip the switch and take us out of here.
Thanks for listening this week. And once again, this episode of Still Entitled was brought to you by the new Unscaled series from All Turtles Podcasts. AI is changing nearly everything about the way businesses grow and solve problems. This shift requires a new understanding of the word scale, and entrepreneurs need to pay attention. This 8-part podcast series looks at how startups and founders can use the new unscaled model to make products with impact. Listen to this provocative new series at allturtlespodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.